Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how water shaped our past and how new water challenges are shaping our future. We'll discuss the nearly secret life of water. Then, in the wake of President Obama's new climate plan, three of the world's top scientists assess how to heal this planet. Although it's the most important substance in our lives, we hardly think about water, where it comes from, how it's used, and its precarious future. Water determines the outcome of just about everything, the fate of cities, the production of everything from a pair of jeans, a flat-screen TV, to concrete and food. All that is alive is completely dependent on it. And now, as our water sources and water purity are increasingly threatened by overuse, pollution, climate change, and a growing human population, it is going to reshape how we live. Perhaps it is time to learn about this profoundly important substance, according to our next guest. Award-winning author and journalist Charles Fishman joins us now to discuss his latest book, The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. Welcome, Charles Fishman.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. Perhaps we should start with a few water facts. You start with the ways in which we use and need water in your book and the ways that we waste it. Give us some numbers. Give us the scope.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The average American uses 99 gallons of real water a day for things like taking a bath, washing your hands, boiling pasta, making coffee, flushing the toilet. But just at home, the electricity that each of us uses at home is 250 gallons of water a day. So 10 gallons an hour, every hour of every day for each of us, not per family, to keep the computers running and the flat screen TV on and the refrigerator cold. We need more than twice as much water to make the electricity that our homes use as we do for the actual water we use. That's just a tiny example. Everybody's omnipresent cell phones, their laptop computers, their tablet computers, every computer chip in the world requires a kind of water that is so clean, it is literally considered too clean to drink. Drinking it would leach the nutrients right back out of your body. And so again, whoever imagines that their iPhone requires water or a particular kind of sort of exotic water, you know, there's water required for almost everything we do, and most of it is hidden.
Now, compare the United States' water usage with the rest of the world.
Well, the Americans, as with many other things in the world, Americans are large consumers of water. On a per capita basis, in the developed world, we're the largest users of water out there. But per capita water use is a little misleading. For instance, all of the agriculture in the United States, the per capita water use, the per person water use in the country, includes all the farmers and all the power plants. So industrialized nations end up with pretty high per person water use. What's interesting in the United States is that as a country, we use more water in a day than we use oil in a year. And I think that's so startling because you hear so much about the price of oil and so much about the availability of oil. We literally use more water in a single day than we use oil in a whole year as a country. And look how little attention water gets. And I think this is one of the most hopeful things I discovered in reporting this book. The United States actually uses less water today as a country than we did in 1980. We've gotten much more efficient in the big users of water over the last 25, 30 years. So we use less water to produce an economy of $13 trillion than we did to produce an economy of $6 trillion. We've literally doubled the economic output of the country without increasing the amount of water we needed to use at all. And that's pretty impressive.
One of the things you point out is that some 40% of the world doesn't have good access to water. So give us the lay of the land here. Who has it? Who doesn't? And what is this phrase, water wealth and water poverty?
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, it is not that much different than other necessities of life in the world. People of means, people with good jobs, people who live in developed world countries have such good access to water that they never think about it. So there are very small pockets of the United States that don't have good water service, and unfortunately those are mostly on the reservations of Native American peoples. But in general, 97% of Americans have such good water service, they never think about it. The same is true across the developed world, in Canada, across Europe. The water service is so good, it's invisible. And it's also incredibly inexpensive. We never even think about the price of water. In fact, across the U.S., not only don't ordinary people think about the price of their water at home, most businesses don't have to think about the price of water at all. Most farmers don't think about the price of water. They just use it. The 40% of people who don't have good access to water, that's amazing. Think about that for a minute. Wherever you work, whatever restaurant you're in, whatever school you go to, look to the left and the right. 4 out of 10 people in the world don't have good access to water, and yet we don't know anybody like that, although it's almost half the world. So about 15 to 20% of the world literally does not have access to clean, safe water. They drink muddy water and very small amounts, whatever they can get every day. And another 20% of the world has to walk every single day to get water. For that 40% of the world, water is actually probably the thing they think about most in their day. It shapes, access to water shapes their entire day. The 20% of the world that relies on walking to get water, they start the day walking to get water, and they end the day walking to get water. And if they're lucky, there are 3 or 4 hours in the middle of the day where they don't have to worry about fetching water. The availability of water literally determines whether people can go to school, what their access to, you know, economic opportunities and good jobs are. So I use the phrase water poverty and water wealth because I think lack of water doesn't just impoverish you in terms of the water. It actually impoverishes you in the larger sense because lack of access to water limits your other economic opportunities.
And what's happening now, as you point out, is that water access and access to clean water is changing as a result of all kinds of developments, including climate change and including the new pollutants that are the micropollutants that you talk about. Give us a little bit of a sketch of what happened, for example, in Spain and what happened in some of the places in the United States as well in roughly 2008. Walk us through, starting with Spain.
Well, Spain was one of the European countries that was hit by a terrible drought, the area of Catalonia. And Barcelona, which is an enormous city of 5 million people, was running so short of water that they actually established an emergency pipeline project to bring water in from another region. They were building a water pipeline right down the middle of a superhighway. They used the right-of-way between the lanes going in opposite directions, and they were spending roughly $40 million to build that pipeline. And Barcelona was so concerned about water, they turned off the fountains. That's a city that is famous for its fountains. They turned off the beachside showers and started trying to, they contracted to bring in water by tanker, the same kind of tankers that move oil around the world, although these were obviously food-grade tankers. They hadn't been carrying petroleum any time recently. But it was a kind of silly gesture. It cost millions and millions of dollars, and twice a week a tanker would pull up to the docks in Barcelona. The docks had been modified to accommodate the ships, and those ships unloaded their entire cargoes of water, and it would provide 35 minutes of water for the city. And so what it really served to do was illustrate that you have to manage water problems in a much larger framework. If you get desperate and you're running a city of millions of people, tankers full of water will not rescue you. You have to have thought a little further ahead. In the United States, Atlanta also came close to running out of water. They rely on a nearby reservoir, and the reservoir dropped so that Atlanta really only had about 80 days of water. And again, Atlanta has doubled in size and doubled in size again since about 1970. And yet the people responsible for managing Atlanta's growth and for making sure Atlanta has what it needs have never gone and tried to get secure new water supplies for the city. Atlanta actually sits in a pretty water-wealthy region in terms of natural rainfall and nearby lakes and so forth. But as the city began to run short of water, it was too late to go laying, you can't lay emergency pipelines for a city of 4 or 5 million people in 2 months. Things like that take planning, time, permitting. I hope that those kinds of examples, which I describe in some detail in the book, will sort of serve as a wake-up call. Atlanta is the perfect example of a place that has never thought about its water supply, and yet when a two-year-long drought settled in over the southeastern United States, all across Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, the water supplies dried up, and cities large and small found themselves in difficult positions. I think the point of telling those stories is to say both citizens and the people in charge of government and water supplies need to say, you know, it may be the case that the water situation we live with every day now might change. If the rainfall here fell 20 or 30% 3 years in a row, what would our water situation be then, and what can we do in advance? It's like having a fire extinguisher. You're never sorry you did some good water planning in advance. You know, you don't look at the fire extinguisher on your sink in the kitchen or on the wall at the office and say, "Boy, that was a waste of money." If you need it, you're really glad it's there.
I thought it was quite funny that the way Georgia tried to handle their water crisis was by moving their border.
Well, it happens that Georgia and Atlanta sit just below the Tennessee River. And even in the midst of this drought, the Tennessee River is such a big river that there was more than enough water in it. But the Georgia border is below the Tennessee River. All they would need to do would have been to have had a border a mile further to the north. And so the Georgia legislature voted to move the border. Thank goodness states don't get to determine their own borders. And the Tennessee legislature was not interested in ceding any part of the Tennessee River to their neighbors to the south. There'd been no reason, of course. It's a funny example and silly, and it shows, you know, how absurd supposedly responsible people will be when it comes to solving water problems. But there had been no reason they couldn't have negotiated to get water from the Tennessee River in advance before the crisis, in case a crisis came along. Why wouldn't Tennessee have been willing to sell some of that water? It's just flowing down the river anyway, right? So it's both silly but also an example of how if you think far enough in advance, most water problems turn out not to be water problems. They turn out to be people problems.
The New York Times, I believe this was on the front page, the lead in a story about China's water crisis said, quote, "North China is dying. A chronic drought is ravaging farmland. The Gobi Desert is inching south. The Yellow River, the so-called birthplace of Chinese civilization, is so polluted it can no longer supply drinking water." It's really a global problem. You also talked about Australia at length, about all of the problems in Australia. And the weather patterns are changing.
Absolutely. So, yes, the story of the New York Times about China is about China deciding that it's going to move enormous volumes of water from one part of the country to the other. The story described it as supplying water to Boston, New York, and Washington using canals from the Mississippi River. If you can imagine a canal that would cross all of Kentucky, Ohio, Massachusetts, New York, you know, another one arcing down toward Washington, D.C. Well, they're actually trying to do that in China with all kinds of implications. Now, that looks kind of astonishing and in some ways desperate to us. We, of course, did the same thing out west. I mean, that's how California, Arizona, and Las Vegas, Nevada are supplied with water with big diversion projects and big dam projects. We just did them 60 or 70 years ago, and so we've grown accustomed to them. I'm going to take issue with one thing you said. I think it's dangerous to say it's a global problem. The problems that are happening in North China and the problems that happened in Atlanta and the problems that happened in Barcelona and the problems that happened in Australia aren't directly connected to each other. That is, we can say, oh boy, those folks down in Atlanta sure are in trouble, but I live in Philadelphia. Even if we have lots of water here, and we do, there's no way of helping the people in Atlanta. The people in Atlanta have to solve their own water problem. We can be sympathetic to the problems of China or sympathetic to the problems of Australia, but each region, even within those countries, has to tackle its own water problem. You know, the people in Orlando can't help the people in Atlanta. And if you all in California figure out how to solve your water problems, the good news is the people in Minnesota can't undo it. They can't take some action that will undo your solution. So I think while lots of places in the world are having water problems at the same time, and the reasons for those water problems are related sort of thematically, climate change, economic development, growing population, it's important to remember that water problems are local, and the people who are having the problems have the ability in general to grab hold of them and figure out how to solve them. But polluted rivers in China means there's water, and there's somebody tainting the water, making it unusable, but there is water available. And so you could begin to fix the problem by not allowing people to destroy the water supply that you rely on, for instance. I think it's important to understand that while there may be this sort of outbreak of water problems in lots of different places around the world, it's not like the global economic crisis. You have to solve your own water problems, and most of the time, the tools to solve those problems are right at hand if we're willing to look at them clearly.
Well, let's talk about one of those examples. You noted that Las Vegas, which is the casino capital and has been using enormous amounts of water for its entertainment, and it's in the middle of a desert. You noted that they actually came up with some interesting creative solutions to keep this kind of crazy water display going. Talk about what happened.
Well, Las Vegas is a really interesting case. It's the driest city in America by far. Of the 280 largest cities in America, 280 gets you pretty far down the list. Las Vegas is far and away the driest. They get 4 inches of rain a year. It only rains about 20 days a year in Las Vegas. The temperature is over 100 for something like 75 days. So it's over 100 degrees in Las Vegas many more days a year than it actually rains. And Las Vegas relies on essentially a single source for all its water, Lake Mead, which is an enormous reservoir just outside the city. Lake Mead's actually 110 miles long, vast lake that is backed up by Hoover Dam. But Las Vegas can't take whatever it wants from Lake Mead. Las Vegas is limited by federal agreement to a very specific amount of water that hasn't changed in 50 years. So Las Vegas has, like Atlanta, Las Vegas has grown like mad. It, too, has doubled and doubled again in the last 30 years in terms of population, 3 or 4 times the number of people living there now as living there in 1970, but no new water available at all. And so Las Vegas really has had to reimagine how a city like that can manage its water use because it's only got one slug of water. They've imposed all kinds of fascinating rules to change the culture. It is now illegal in Las Vegas to have a front lawn. All new houses, starting back in about 2000, are forbidden to have front lawns. And those same houses are only allowed grass on half of whatever the backyard is. The rest of the landscaping needs to be indigenous desert landscaping appropriate to Las Vegas. Well, 70% of the water that homeowners use in Las Vegas goes to watering the lawn. So if you begin to reduce the amount of lawn there is, then you begin to gradually over time reduce the amount of water they use. It's illegal to let your lawn sprinklers, if you're part of the grandfathered group or whatever lawn you have, it's illegal to let them hit the pavement or hit a road. They must hit only landscaped areas. And they actually have water cops who will fine you. They specify the kind of hose nozzle you can use to wash your car. It has to have an automatic shutoff. It only works when you're pressing on it. So they tell you what days you can water the lawn and what hours you can water, because watering in the middle of the day in the middle of the desert means you're wasting enormous quantities of water that simply evaporate, that never do any good for your lawn. The most important thing Las Vegas has done, though, is a kind of hidden measure, which is really important. Las Vegas collects every drop of water that is used indoors anywhere in the city, cleans it to a much higher level than is typical in most American cities, and returns it right to Lake Mead. Las Vegas recycles more than 90% of the water that hits a drain anywhere in the metro region. So they actually reuse their water over and over again. They clean it clean enough to put back in Lake Mead and get ready to be taken out again. And that's a number no American city can even come close to that Las Vegas hits. That also means you're not allowed to empty your swimming pool into a storm drain in Las Vegas. You're not allowed to empty your hot tub into a storm drain. You have to empty it right into the sanitary sewer. Because if you're going to dump 10,000 gallons worth of swimming pool water, they want it right back in the system, cleaned up, and returned to Lake Mead, not sprayed out across your lawn. The result is that they have really changed how people think about water and water use in Las Vegas. And over the last 20 years, they've reduced the per-person use of water by 30%. And so they've been able to grow the city without having to add water sources by changing how people use their water and even how they think about it. You know, no one would imagine letting their sprinkler spray on a hot road, which is something that happens all the time across America.
Let's talk for a minute about bottled water.
Okay.
And as you pointed out, a lot of times, you know, our infrastructure starts to fall apart. People don't want to pay for the infrastructure. They say, we'll buy bottled water. That doesn't work for multiple reasons. Give us the cost, the collective cost of bottled water on our system, and also give us the truth about bottled water.
Well, it's interesting. I got started on the path to writing The Big Thirst with a story about bottled water. I spent several months trying to understand the bottled water business. I grew up in the 1960s and 1970s when there was no bottled water at all. We used water fountains. We drank out of the tap at home. There literally was no bottled water business. And I was puzzled as a journalist where the business had come from. After all, we're buying something in stores that is literally free in our homes. And there are lots of things we're very touchy about the price of, so why would we be spending money for something we get free? You asked about the cost, and I think this is one of the more striking things, another way that we sort of don't connect the dots in the water world. In the United States, we spend $21 billion a year on bottled water as consumers every year, $21 billion a year. We spend $29 billion a year maintaining the entire water infrastructure of the country, all the treatment plants, the pumps, the pipes, modernization, maintenance, the whole thing. So we spend almost as much on crushable plastic bottles filled with water as we do on the entire critical infrastructure for the country. So when people say to me there's no money in the system for fixing the water system, I just laugh and say, no, actually there is. In fact, we're already spending that money on water. It's just coming one little plastic bottle at a time. I actually don't think it's my job or anybody's job to tell you whether to drink bottled water or not. I think if people understand it, they'll be a little less inclined to drink it. It's not my job to tell you whether you should be drinking Fiji water or San Pellegrino or Evian, but those products do leave an incredible trail behind them. Only about 25% of the plastic bottles get recycled. So 75% of the plastic bottles in which bottled water is delivered end up in the landfill, which is just ridiculous. You think about that plastic bottle as a kind of a permanent container. It will never go away. 100 years ago, it would have been considered a miracle to have a bottle that was that light and that strong that you could use over and over again. We literally take four swallows of water, and then we throw the 1,000-year container in the garbage. Anybody who's drinking bottled water should at least take the trouble to make sure the container gets recycled. And the truth is, some people drink bottled water because they like the taste. Some people think it's safer. It is certainly no safer than tap water. In fact, it is not as closely regulated as tap water. So there are people who say they can tell the difference. In blind taste tests with water exactly the same temperature, almost no one, including the bottled water people, can ever tell the difference. And the truth is, you drink tap water, it's a little warm out of the tap. You drink bottled water, it's ice cold out of the refrigerator case in the store or out of your own refrigerator. Plus, it comes in the bottle, so you sort of have a psychological association. But it is absolutely no safer. And part of the impact is what we started out talking about, which is bottled water will not save you. Atlanta could not have relied on bottled water if Lake Lanier, its reservoir, ran desperately low. There's not enough bottled water in the country to keep even one city going on a regular basis. I think bottled water has a tendency to undermine confidence in tap water, and the truth is that the municipal water system of the country is vital to the economic vibrancy of the country. We need to not confuse bottled water with municipal water systems.
Let's talk for a moment about the Safe Drinking Water Act. You noted that it's 35 years old and it has 91 contaminants that it regulates, but there are a whole host of new ones, micropollutants, drugs. What is the reality of the pollutants in our water and in contrast with the Safe Drinking Water Act?
Well, the Safe Drinking Water Act has been updated a couple times in the last 30 years, but it's clearly out of date compared to what the threats to the water supply are. And anybody who's listening can sort of just think about themselves and the people they know. I don't think my parents took any medicines routinely when they were the age that I am. You know, we not only take Motrin and acetaminophen when our backs bother us in middle age, plenty of people are on maintenance high blood pressure drugs, maintenance cholesterol drugs, maintenance birth control pills that didn't even exist 50 years ago, maintenance antidepressants. So all of that stuff is great in medical terms, but a little bit of it leaks out of our bodies every time we pee, and it ends up in the toilet, and it ends up in the water supply. And the current treatment plant, the wastewater treatment plants that the water goes to from your home, and the water treatment plants that are responsible for cleaning fresh water and delivering it to us at the front end, none of those are set up to take out this class of kind of pharmaceutical, what I call micropollutant. These products appear in absolutely minuscule quantities. An average person might earn $10 million in the course of an entire life of earnings, and these micropollutants appear in the equivalent of less than one penny out of $10 million, a lifetime's earnings. So very, very small quantities. And yet, we keep adding, and these drugs are specifically designed to have an impact at minuscule levels. Your question was, what's the truth about those pollutants? And unfortunately, the truth is we don't know. We don't know what impact they have on human beings. They clearly have an impact on fish and other marine and amphibious life when those pollutants begin to accumulate in lakes and rivers and bodies of water. Now, of course, the fish and the amphibians are living in the water. They're not drinking, you know, a liter a day. They're actually swimming through it and breathing it all the time. So they're much more likely to be sensitive and much more likely to be affected by small quantities. Those things can, in fact, be taken out of the water. It's not actually a technical challenge at all. It's simply a financial challenge. Only about 10% of the water that each of us uses each day is used for potable purposes. Most of it, 90% of it, goes for things that don't require purified water. If you were to take all those micropollutants out of every gallon of municipal water in the country, you'd double the water bill. Now, of course, the water bill is only $35 a month on average, $34 a month on average for an American home. So even doubling the water bill would barely bring it up to what our cell phones cost. But Americans wouldn't tolerate that. We need a new sort of focus of research on what those micropollutants do both to us and to the environment where they sit after we, you know, use those products and the wastewater is discharged into a river or a lake or wherever. And we probably need a little bit of a technical leap to take those micropollutants back out. And the place to take them out isn't before we drink the water, but at the point at which wastewater is treated, so that we don't actually taint the environment where the water is deposited with these man-made pharmaceuticals, the impact of which we're just trying to understand. We're ready for a kind of a second revolution in water cleanliness, and I hope that gets enough attention. That is something people pay attention to. They don't want Prozac in their drinking water, even in very small quantities.
Well, Charles Fishman, the book is called The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back, three of the world's top scientists assess how to heal this planet. Stay tuned.
The drumfish, they beach themselves in Harukari. The blackbirds, they fell in thousands from the sky. Their red wings streaming down from the higher seas. Deflected by the ground, they crown the sun. They crown the sun. They crown the sun.
This is the Scholar Circle. ScholarCircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. Last week, President Obama released the National Climate Assessment about the state of the U.S. in the face of climate change. The report detailed the drastic changes being witnessed across the U.S. as a result of global warming that has increased by less than 2 degrees. The U.S. president used the report to try and help average Americans understand how greenhouse gases from coal and carbon emissions are behind the worsening wildfires, heat waves, and storms that have been on the rise. Last year at this time, after the Congress failed to act on climate change, President Obama issued an executive order as an effort to lead the country in addressing the climate concerns. In light of the latest report, we revisit the science and President Obama's executive order with top climate scholars. Michael Mann is a professor of meteorology at Penn State University and the director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. Dr. Mann is author of Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick in the Climate Wars. He is also a lead author for the 2007 Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, for which he, his co-authors, and Vice President Al Gore won the Nobel Prize. Peter Ward is professor of biology at the University of Washington. He is the author of Our Flooded Earth, Under a Green Sky, and Out of Thin Air, Dinosaurs, Birds, and Earth's Ancient Atmosphere. Mark Jacobson also joins us. He is a professor of civil and environmental engineering and director of the Atmosphere Energy Program at Stanford University. He is the author of Air Pollution and Global Warming, History, Science, and Solutions, and Atmospheric Pollution, History, Science, and Regulation. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us. I'd like to start with the science and the reality of what we have today. We recently passed this 400 part per million concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That's about 50 parts per million higher than what is the tipping point number that scientists have been saying. We're seeing considerable changes in the weather, storm patterns. Michael Mann, can you give us a briefing about what it is we're facing?
Sure. We know that we've just passed this number, 400 parts per million, which is unprecedented in modern civilization, in modern human history. In fact, we probably have to go back several million years to find CO2 concentrations, carbon dioxide concentrations, that were that high in the past. And so we are engaged in an unprecedented experiment with the Earth, with fossil fuel burning and the elevation of the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and we are already seeing the impacts of climate change. It is, of course, true that you can't point at any one specific weather event and say for certain that that was due to climate change, but we are seeing more extreme weather of various sorts as a result of the loading of the weather dice by climate change.
Two things that you just said. One is you use the word experiment, leading one to think that maybe we don't really know what's coming. But at the same time, we know from some of the history and some of the research you've done, like one you did in 2006, about the Atlantic hurricane trends being linked to climate change. How do we piece all this together?
You know, we understand the basic science here, the basic physics. It's not very complicated. You sometimes hear the claim made that climate change, that global warming, is based on elaborate models that can't be trusted. Just the opposite is the case. It's based on simple physics and chemistry we've known for nearly two centuries, the greenhouse effect, irrefutable measurements of how we are increasing the concentrations of these greenhouse gases in the atmosphere through fossil fuel burning. We understand the physics and the chemistry well enough to draw certain conclusions. And one of those conclusions is that we will see far more warming over the next century, and we will see more widespread drought, and we will see more sea level rise. We will see an array of far greater and potentially more damaging impacts of climate change if we continue on the course that we're on, if we continue to pump these greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. We're only seeing the tip of the veritable iceberg right now, and already we know that that's associated with more widespread drought, record-breaking heat, wildfires that are far more extensive and damaging than anything we've seen in the past.
Peter Ward, you have argued that the Earth is growing less inhabitable, partly being climate-driven. How much is climate related to this habitability, and can it be reversed?
Well, habitability is an astronomical term, and in some ways, that's kind of a misnomer. I don't really think the Earth will become less habitable it might become less habitable in terms of surface area for we humans. We do a lot better on solid land than we do shallow marine oceanic conditions. If you're in Bangladesh within the next century or two centuries, you're really going to want more solid land. I see, look in the deep past, and you will find times when carbon dioxide levels were as little as, say, 800 to 1,000 parts per million. And there's clear evidence that there was little, if any, ice sheet presence on the planet. All the way back to the Cretaceous, there are arguments back and forth whether there were substantial ice sheets or not. But without doubt, it was a warmer place. And really, without doubt, sea level was much, much higher. And my greatest fear, of course, is the agricultural output of humans as we inexorably increase our population, heading up to 8 to 9 to 10 billion people by the end of the century, according to some people. We're reducing the most important of all agricultural fields, and those are on deltas. Deltas don't like even a meter sea level rise. The rice output of this planet really keeps a lot of us fed, and if we melt ice sheets, not ice caps, but ice sheets, sea level rises very quickly, as Michael said.
The climate factors into this exactly how, and how does it relate to the extinction patterns that you have been studying?
Michael hit it all. I mean, the climate is affected especially by droughts. Places like the Great Valley, where it snows in the winter, the snow line rises. It doesn't snow in the winter anymore. It comes down as rain. But by the summertime, when the farmers of the Great Valley of California really need a lot of water for irrigation, it isn't there anymore. The same thing has happened in China. You're seeing enormous fights taking place for all the water coming out of the Himalayas between China and Pakistan, and that we will increasingly see this strife and increasingly see, I think, the forced migration of various peoples to try to find adequate farming land. The drought pattern that Michael mentioned is part of this. Sea level rise is a second part of this. Look, we depend upon stability for agriculture. The farmer's almanac, year after year, we depend that this particular wheat crop or that rice crop is going to come back. But with rapid climate change, it may not. In terms of longer-term processes, we do know that all of the major mass extinctions, including now the Cretaceous-Paleogene mass extinction, had a component of rapid greenhouse gas increases from volcanic sources. It used to be thought that the KPG, as we call it, the old KT, was almost exclusively asteroidal from its content of extinction, but the Deccan Traps, big flood basalts, where massive volumes of lava pour out onto the Earth's surface and at the same time cause huge amounts of greenhouse gases to enter the atmosphere. We see that at the end of the Permian, we see it at the end of the Cretaceous, at the end of the Triassic. We now have just documented it from our work at the end of the Devonian, that this rapid rise causes oceanic currents to reduce, and as they do, oxygen content of the deep oceans diminishes, and when it gets down to a certain very low level, we change over the microbial content, producing very rapid marine extinction.
Mark Jacobson.
I think it's really important to address the rapid climate change today because, in addition to all the effects mentioned, the sea ice in the Arctic is disappearing rapidly. It may disappear entirely, at least in the summer, but possibly year-round within 10 to 30 years. And this could cause a positive feedback that can accelerate climate change even more. Severe storming is a significant problem. The effects of global warming on air pollution, the enhancement of air pollution due to higher temperatures, already 2.5 to 3 million people die every year from pollution. That is increasing as the climate is getting warmer. And all these, the air pollution problem, the climate problem, they all speak to the need for rapid solutions to them. And I can't stress how urgent it is to have solutions that are implemented immediately, and we can't wait like 10, 20, or 30 years before we start implementing them.
One of the questions I have before we talk about the specific solutions, President Obama has introduced this plan relatively unilaterally because the Congress is certainly not being very helpful. I understand that a lot of elevated emissions are actually coming from places like China and India. If the United States were to take on an aggressive climate plan, how much difference will it make if the other parts of the world are then increasing their emissions? Michael Mann?
Sure. I think it's a matter of moral authority and leadership. It is true that the greatest increase in greenhouse gas emissions is likely to come from the developing world. But in turn, they look at the U.S. and they say, you had two centuries of free access to fossil fuel energy. Don't we deserve our turn? And it's difficult for us to tell them otherwise if we don't have our own house in order. And so what I think the president's directive, the president's plan does, is at the very least establish that the U.S. is taking this issue seriously, that we are going to do something about our ongoing greenhouse gas emissions. It's unfortunate that intransigence in the Congress has led to these executive actions being the only way to deal with our rising greenhouse gas emissions. After all, to solve this problem the way many conservatives say they would like to see the problem solved, you have to put a dollar amount on the emission of carbon. You've got to price the emission of carbon into the economy. And there are free market approaches to doing that, whether they be carbon taxes or cap and trade legislation. The bottom line is that because we have had a Congress that's unwilling to have that important discussion about comprehensive energy and climate plan, we can only rely right now, at least, on these sorts of executive actions.
Let's turn to some of these solutions. Mark Jacobson, perhaps I should hand this to you first to outline the various types of solutions that you have analyzed. You looked at a wide range and assessed them really for their feasibility on a number of variables.
Well, we've looked at different methods of addressing global warming, air pollution, and energy security. And the first step was to evaluate different technologies, and the technologies that seemed to be the best were kind of obvious, didn't require too much of a study, but we did do a study looking at wind and concentrated solar power, photovoltaics, geothermal power, some tidal, a little bit of wave, even though those aren't too large of technologies, and some hydroelectricity. So these are recommended options, which we call wind, water, and solar technologies, or WWS, powering electricity and hydrogen. So our idea would be to convert the entire world's energy infrastructure for all purposes, that's electricity, transportation, heating and cooling, and industrial processes, to one driven by electricity primarily, powered by these energy technologies, and some amounts of hydrogen that are developed from electricity. We did not recommend nuclear power, coal with carbon capture or sequestration, natural gas or biofuels of any type, either for heating or electricity. Not because some of these aren't better in some respects than what we have today, but because they're not nearly so good as what we could have with wind, water, solar. For example, natural gas puts out about 60 times more carbon equivalent emissions than wind energy per kilowatt hour. Nuclear is about 9 to 25 times more when you account for not only the life cycle emissions, but also the opportunity costs from the long time lag between planning and operation. But based on the best technologies that we proposed, we developed plans for the U.S. and worldwide in some individual states now, California and New York in particular, to repower either the states or the countries or the world with these energy technologies, and looked at the technical and economic feasibility of doing this. And we found that there was no technical or economic even limit. Most of the barriers were social and political. For example, to repower the entire world's energy infrastructure, the first thing we found is that if you do this conversion to electricity and electrolytic hydrogen, you can reduce the world power demand without changing your habits by about 32% because of the efficiency of electricity versus combustion. But then you can add additional efficiency measures to reduce that demand. And then the rest could be powered by these wind, water, and solar technologies. And the land areas would not be large. Maybe for the world, it would be about 0.6% of the land area, plus some offshore area for what we call footprint, and then additional 1% for spacing between, for example, wind turbines, which is open space. And the materials are not limits. The costs of clean energy are coming down. Onshore wind right now and hydro and geothermal are all cost competitive. Wind was the largest new source of electric power in the U.S. last year, followed by natural gas, and solar and coal were tied for third and fourth. The nice thing about these technologies is the fuel cost is essentially free, and so you stabilize the fuel cost, whereas fossil fuel costs keep rising each year. And so we can see that in the states, for example, in the U.S., with the highest penetration of wind, which are South Dakota, Iowa, North Dakota, Minnesota, and Wyoming, the cost of electricity in those states has gone up only 2 cents a kilowatt hour between 2003 and 2011, whereas all the other states went up about 3.6 cents. Hawaii went up 17 cents a kilowatt hour because of the high fossil fuel costs themselves relative to wind in particular. So we've looked at this in detail and also in terms of the job creation and found you can get a lot of jobs, especially in the solar industry, and you don't lose. So there's the job benefits, there's the stabilizing the price benefits, and there's the reduction of all the air pollution. As I mentioned before, 2.5 to 3 million people are killed each year prematurely from air pollution. That would be eliminated. And global warming emissions would also be eliminated through this plan, since everything that's, or just about everything, since there's some agricultural stuff that's not eliminated, this is all energy-related emissions, would all be set to zero.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about real solutions to the climate change problem. Peter Ward, we should bring you in to talk about the agricultural aspect and the population aspect, two things that you mentioned. How do we address these?
One point that is related to that that I think didn't get enough comment here, you're asking how would you get India and China to actually start mending their ways. Well, we in the U.S., of course, with our standard of living, are still per capita producing as much carbon emissions or more than any other individual people on the planet. But I think moral authority that Michael said just isn't going to work. They're going to just say, hey, look, you guys have that high standard of living, and we don't. So there's sort of two ways to this, is that you try to get to the rest of the world up to an equivalent standard of living. Those countries that are rich enough can afford ecological and actually good solutions to energy problems and pollution problems. But cheap energy is the way that a country that is not rich gets rich, and cheap energy means coal. To my sense, we have to stop all coal burning on this planet. It's the single most dangerous aspect, followed maybe by Athabasca tar sands from Canada. I mean, these are unbelievably dangerous aspects to the global climate. Coal burning in China, you hear all kinds of apocryphal stories about how many plants open per week and on, but Obama's right. It is the coal-fired power plants that themselves are really a major problem with this.
And in terms of the agriculture and the issue around feeding the growing population, any ideas?
We all talk about cutting emissions. Why don't we talk about cutting population? In the 1970s, there was a very powerful group called ZPG, or Zero Population Growth. Well, that's essentially gone. Part of the equation certainly has to be reducing the number of humans to feed. And yet that conversation is never brought up. It needs to be part of the whole climate change population, because the more humans there are, the more rapidly we change the climate. In terms of agriculture, David Battisti at the University of Washington, where I work, has published a very scary finding that, in fact, rising carbon dioxide reduces crop output of some very important crops. And so we really need to look closely. Personally, I favor genetically engineered crops to some extent, and yet we know that these can cause runaway genes to escape and that they themselves can create enormous problems. So technology in itself is going to be part of the solution, but technology always presents a dangerous aspect to itself. We have to be able to feed all these people, because when we don't, when sea level covers over a significant portion of cropland, and it will, we produce global conflict. So to me, global conflict, somebody who lets off a nuclear bomb somewhere, and I'll tell you, you've got a world that's very, very badly damaged, and populations trying to move from one place to another in the next century could very well be the excuse for someone to do that.
Michael Mann.
Yeah, well, I think one implicit point here that we haven't fully fleshed out is the fact that our emission of carbon is actually doing damage. It's doing monetary damage. It's costing us about $1 trillion in global gross domestic product a year. It's already costing us more than any action to curtail greenhouse gas emissions would cost. So the damages already outweigh any costs of mitigation. And when you incorporate that, when you take into account the damage that it's doing to food security, national security, water security, human health, air quality, as Mark alluded to, agriculture, as Peter has alluded to, when you incorporate those damages into the equation, what you find is that it already is economically more favorable to develop and scale up renewable energy technologies, non-carbon emitting energy technologies. And so again, the marketplace can solve this problem as long as the playing field is level. But right now, the playing field isn't level. We're greatly subsidizing fossil fuel energy, which we know is degrading the climate, it's degrading the planet, and we're not providing equal incentives for other renewable sources of energy, which, as Mark has explained, really could be scaled up to meet our energy demands in a relatively short amount of time if we were properly incentivized the development and the deployment of these technologies.
Mark Jacobson?
Yes, I can agree with what everybody else has said so far. We need this rapid transformation. While I encourage the direction President Obama is taking, I kind of fear that what he was proposing was very small in terms of actual solution to our problem. Just for example, you know, he's proposing 6 million homes be powered by renewable energy by 2020. Well, that sounds like a lot, but it's only 4.5% of the homes in the United States, and it doesn't even account for commercial and government buildings. He's proposing 3 billion metric tons of accumulated carbon cuts in the next 20 years, but that's only half the annual carbon emissions of the U.S., so it's really effectively a total of 1/40 the annual emissions are being cut each year. He wanted to reduce subsidies from fossil fuels, but he's giving an $8 billion loan guarantee for coal with carbon capture, which is another subsidy. So, which in coal with carbon capture actually increases air pollution emissions because you need 25% more energy to run the carbon capture equipment, and therefore 25% more mining and transport of coal, sulfur emissions, particulate matter emissions, hydrocarbon, mercury emissions. Everything goes up except for the carbon dioxide comes down, and it doesn't even come down a whole lot because you still have mining and transport of the coal. So you still have about 50 times more carbon than wind energy. And that, well, he is proposing energy efficiency measures, which are good. Those are a good part of it. But everything else is pretty trivial and in terms of what we really need to do. And so I'd really encourage, you know, policymakers to look hard at what is needed and take the big steps because, you know, at this pace we're going, you know, nothing beneficial is going to come of this. And we need these kind of much more rapid changes over a shorter period of time.
Well, maybe we should talk about the policy making and politics. Michael Mann, you've been very engaged in both the science and the policy process, and you've been sort of personally injured by the rough and tumble. Can these big solutions be advanced at this point? And along with that, given the last wave of storms and droughts, have you seen the denial senators, such as Imhoff, change, or is there still a strong denial lobby?
Well, sadly, I think as long as there is huge amounts of funding from fossil fuel interests and the various front groups that they fund, we're probably not going to see dramatic changes in the politics of this issue right now. That is, in fact, what forced the president to take, you know, what Mark has admittedly described as fairly modest executive actions. In essence, we're hemorrhaging carbon into the atmosphere, and the president's plan amounts to a few Band-Aids. It's not going to be the solution to the problem. What we need to do, of course, is to incentivize a move away from fossil fuel energy, and you're not going to do that without pricing carbon into the marketplace. And, you know, increasingly, you hear conservatives speaking out. In fact, to some extent, this latest executive action was a signal to conservatives as to why they should have been pushing for marketplace solutions earlier. Because in the absence of a market-based solution, you're going to see other approaches, like executive approaches, that to some will seem heavy-handed. There are an increasing number of conservatives, people on the conservative side of our political spectrum, that recognize that climate change is real. We can't just wish it away. We can't pretend it doesn't exist, though we do have fossil fuel-funded politicians like James Inhofe continuing to claim that it's a hoax when the science is overwhelmingly on the side of the problem being real and the issue being a real threat if we don't do something. Now, there are, like I said, an increasing number of conservatives, people like David Frum, who was a former speechwriter for President Bush, he used to write for the National Review, and has come out and said, we need to explore free market solutions to pricing carbon. That's the conservative approach to dealing with a problem that is very real. And so what I'm hoping, and what we are starting to see, is a bit of a schism within the conservative community between the sort of far-right Tea Party, like Koch brother-funded politicians like James Inhofe, and the sort of thinking conservatives like David Frum, who want to have that worthy debate, because there is a worthy debate to be had about policy, about how to go about solving this problem. But there isn't a worthy debate to be had about whether or not the problem exists. And it is my hope that what we're going to see is some of those conservatives become part of a larger coalition for moving forward, having that policy debate about how to solve the problem, but recognizing that the problem is real, recognizing that climate change presents one of the greatest threats to human civilization, to national security, I think we're going to see the problem begin to become framed in those terms, and we will see action. We will see, you know, momentum towards the direction of solving the problem when that happens.
Peter Ward, put this into the long historic context that you've been studying.
Well, there's the famous overused saying that those who ignore history are actually, in our case, doomed to repeat it. My biggest frustration with the whole climate change debate has been how little deep time has been used to better understand. The experiment we're doing has been done over and over in the past, not by Volvos, but by volcanoes. RealClimate.org, which is, I think, the most successful and interesting of all the educational avenues, is read by the faithful. We are unable to penetrate with this message beyond the group of scientists and the people who actually do understand this. I teach a class in evolution, and we start out the class 300 people strong with who doubts that evolution, organic evolution, is real and who doubts that climate change is real. It started out 5 years ago at about 15%. This last year, it's up to 30%, and that's entering freshmen who are supposedly the best of the best of Washington State high school seniors. We are failing at the public education of trying to get people to understand science and realize that there's perhaps nothing more important than understanding. And finally, we all have to let citizens know that, in fact, one person can make a huge difference. If you look at your carbon footprint through your life and then start multiplying that, because many people come up to me and say, oh, gosh, it's so depressing. What can I do? I can't do anything. We really need to turn that around, that each person on this planet has a stake in it, but is also a part of the problem.
Well, that's perfect place to end. I couldn't have done it better. Mark Jacobson, Peter Ward, Michael Mann, a very big thank you for your work and for sharing your work with us and our listeners.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Maria.
Michael Mann is a professor of meteorology at Penn State University and the director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. Dr. Mann is author of Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick in the Climate Wars. He is also a lead author for the 2007 Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, for which he, his co-authors, and Vice President Al Gore won the Nobel Prize. Peter Ward is professor of biology at the University of Washington. He is the author of Our Flooded Earth, Under a Green Sky, and Out of Thin Air, Dinosaurs, Birds, and Earth's Ancient Atmosphere. Mark Jacobson is a professor of civil and environmental engineering and director of the Atmosphere Energy Program at Stanford University. He is the author of Air Pollution and Global Warming, History, Science, and Solutions, and Atmospheric Pollution, History, Science, and Regulation. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to the Scholar Circle team who makes this show possible, Ankina Aghasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, and Joe Pinto. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed a part of the show, you can go back either to the kpfk.org audio archives, or you can go to scholarcircle.org. You can hear us on iTunes and on Stitcher, and you can follow me at @armudian.